point of the broken hatch. A very small part of her was aware of how she must have looked, a disheveled and battered and dirt-encrusted creature, all but catatonic as she observed the room blankly, and hated herself for her weakness.
"Base, tell me,"
Chirrut's voice, the blind guardian of the wills who had saved her life.
"All of it? The whole city?"
Baze, Chirrut's partner, had a name. He sat beside the blind man with his eyes on the bulkhead. The strobing blue-white light of hyperspace splashed on his cheeks from out of the cockpit.
"Tell me,"
Chirrut said again.
"All of it,"
Baze answered, short and bitter. "Jetta City is gone." Jin examined the thought numbly. The death of Jetta City meant the death of Saw, the deaths of many or all of his soldiers, the deaths of red-robed pilgrims and blustering water vendors. It meant the death of the girl she'd swept into her arms during the fighting in the plaza, the brutal, pointless death of the only person she'd helped in any way since this mission began.
"We call it the Death Star. There is no better name."
The Planet Killer was real. She had mocked it, mocked the Alliance for believing in it. And it was real. If she had believed sooner, kept faith in her father, would anything have been different? Would they have found Saw faster, acted in time to do... What? Was Jetta City her fault, even a little? "Understood." It was Cassian speaking now, a murmur into the comm unit. Then, calling to the droid in the cockpit, "Set course for Edu." Jin repeated Cassian's phrase in her head, tried to hear it over her father's words in the dark of the cave.
"Edu?"
she asked. Her voice sounded thick and hoarse. "Sodden lump of a world, according to the files," Cassian said. He looked at her with a hint of surprise, swiftly hidden. "Small native population, mostly rural nerf herders. Officially, the Empire designates the planet for research and chemical processing."
"Is that where my father is?"
Jin raised her chin, tried to force out the hoarseness. She tried to picture the reunion, tried to picture meeting the man in the hologram for the first time and telling him who she was, telling him, "I saw your message." She should have felt joy at the idea. Her father was a hero. But who she was Leanna Halleck, and Tanith Ponta, and Kestrel Dawn. A blood-stained fighter, and a thief, and a prisoner, who had spent nearly 15 years loathing Galen, locking him in a prison of contempt, until when he needed her, she hadn't believed his warnings about the Death Star at all. She'd have to tell him that, too. The thought brought bile up from her stomach. Could she have been someone else if she'd only known? "I try to think of you only in the moments when I'm strong." "I didn't have a lot of time to question our friend Bodhi," Cassian said. He gestured at the fifth occupant of the cabin, a long-haired man dressed in a stained Imperial flight suit and wearing battered goggles, weaving and unweaving his fingers together. Occasionally, the pilot whispered something without looking up. But Edu's where he said his message came from. "So is your father there?"
"I think so, yes."
Jin nodded distantly. Bodhi's whispers became louder, a stuttered, indecipherable series of sounds. Then he leaned forward in his seat, fully intent on Jin.
"You're Galen's daughter?"
he asked. He looked like he hadn't slept in days. Like he expected everything nearby, bays, the seats, the bulkhead, to clamp jaws around his neck if he dared to blink. He looked almost as pathetic as she did.
"You know him?"
she asked. What did he think of the stranger in her hologram?
"Yes."
She had 100 questions, none of which she wanted the answers to.
"Did he tell you anything?"
"He said..."
Bodhi ducked his head.
"He said I could get right by myself. He said I could make it right, if I was brave enough, and listen to what was in my heart. Do something about it." His lips worked over and over again, forming and swallowing whole sentences before he stilled. "Guess it was too late," he said at last. Jetta City was gone. Saw was gone. His people were gone. The little girl was gone. "It wasn't too late," she said. "At least the pilot had tried."
"Seems pretty late to me," Baze growled. In the silence of the cabin, in the darkness of the cave, Jin listened to her father's recording. "That's the place I've laid my trap." Saw's dying howl echoed. "Save the dream!"
Galen and Saw tore at her together now, asking for what she'd refused them already, demanding recompense for every way she'd failed them, and every day Lyanna and Tanith and Kestrel had lived their own glorious, petty existences. But she had nothing to give them. She was hollow, and even what she'd kept in the cave was lost to darkness. All she had left was the voice of a hologram. Yet she broke anyway. She gave in to the demands because her shame was too great to do otherwise. "No," she whispered. The single word demanded the attention of the ship. "We can beat the people who did this. We can stop them." She would make a deal with the hologram of Galen Erso. She would obey his demand, and he would, if not forgive her, cease to remind her of her failures and her guilt and her loathing. And by the time she met the true Galen Erso on Edu, she would have something to show for it. She spoke evenly, slowly, enunciating each word like she was whetting a blade. "My father's message," she said. "I've seen it. They call it the Death Star. But they have no idea there's a way to defeat it." The tension in Cassian's expression dissipated as he donned his spy's face, his innocently cerebral face. Jin caught it and knew exactly what it meant. "You're wrong about my father," she said. "You think he's still working for the Empire." "He did build it," Cassian said, as if that fact changed everything, and only he was clear-eyed enough to see it. "Because he knew they'd do it without him." She dragged a breath between her teeth and waited for Cassian to object again. She might not know the true Galen Erso, but she spoke with the hologram's voice now, echoed his claims and submission to his cause, to Saw's cause. "My father made a choice," she said, steadying her intonation. "He sacrificed himself for the rebellion. He's rigged a trap inside it, inside the Death Star." She spoke only to Bodhi now. "That's why he sent you, to bring that message." "Where is it?" Cassian asked. Everyone turned to face him. "Where's the message?" he asked. "It was a hologram," Jin said, sharp and fragile as glass. Cassian didn't back down. "You have that message, right?" "What do you think?" she snapped. He knew what had happened to her. He'd witnessed her state in Saul's chambers. She wanted to lunge across the cabin, slam him against the bulkhead, force the calm from his demeanor. She wanted to crack open her skull, let the light and sound of the hologram pour from the cave. "Everything happened so fast, but I've just seen it!" She heard her own ragged insistence as petulant, childish. "You were better off catatonic." Cassian looked to Bodhi now. "Did you see it?" The pilot shook his head and avoided Cassian's gaze.
"You don't believe me," Jin said.
Cassian almost laughed.
"I'm not the one you've got to convince. I'm not the one who can authorize a strike against a Death Star because it might have a weakness. Maybe Mon Mothma."
"I believe her,"
Chirrut interjected. Cassian shook his head in a show of exasperation.
"That's good to know. You're also not part of the Alliance."
Throughout the exchange, Baze had been slumped forward as if drowsing. Now he righted himself, spoke past Cassian and Chirrut.
"What kind of trap?"
he asked.
You said your father made a trap.
The reactor. On this point, Jin was utterly certain. He's placed a weakness there. He's been hiding it for years. He said, if you can blow the reactor, the module, the whole system goes down.
She fixed her gaze on Cassian.
You need to send word to the Alliance, she said. I've done that.
She said the words the hologram needed her to say, bolstered its voice with her own zeal.
Then they have to know there's a way to destroy this thing. My father said we could find the weakness in the structural plans.
We don't have those.
Firm but gentle. Patronizing.
He said if we can find the plans, she insisted, that they're in a data vault on the planet Scarif. Tell the Alliance. They have to go to Scarif and get the plans.
Cassian was silent long enough that Jin thought she had a chance. I can't risk sending that. He answered at last. Even if everything you say is true, we're in the heart of Imperial territory. If the message were intercepted, the whole Alliance fleet could be lured into a trap. He might have been lying, so far as Jin knew, avoiding further argument by positing a threat she couldn't disprove and couldn't counter. In the darkness of the cave, Jin heard her father's recording repeat. If she's alive, if you can possibly find her.
You still want to go to Edu? She asked.
Yes, Cassian said.
There would be no redemption then. No ameliorating her choices or hiding her sins. She would, after all, tell the Galen Erso she'd never met exactly who she was and exactly what the Death Star had done. The only bomb would be whatever he did after. Whatever they both managed, with whatever deal they struck. That would have to be enough to keep her sane in the dark. She had nothing to guide her but the sapphire hologram. Everything else was gone.
Then we'll find him, she said. My father. And we'll bring him back. And he can tell the whole Alliance himself.
She spoke with conviction she did not feel. Cassian nodded, but he wore his spy's face, and Jin couldn't read him at all. Orson Krennic toured the corridors of the Death Star as he had so often before. He listened to the main reactor's muffled roar, like the ebb and flow of a distant ocean's tide. He felt the gentle tremors in the deck plating as the station reconfigured for hyperspace transport. He could even trace the power couplings through the walls, imagine their endpoints in vast artificial caverns. He walked and he could not focus. Tarkin was taking control of his masterwork. Perhaps it was for the best. Perhaps Krennic had spent too long fettered to a single place, a single project. Let Tarkin have the Death Star. He'd soon find the responsibility overwhelming and fail to grasp the battle station's subtle potential. Meanwhile, freed from the behemoth, Krennic would have a flexibility he'd formerly lacked. 100 small victories across the course of a year might be preferable to one great work over decades. He would have his audience with the Emperor soon enough. But this rosiest of scenarios was only possible because Tarkin had outmaneuvered him over Jedha. And Tarkin had outmaneuvered him thanks to the betrayal of Galen Erso. That the Grand Moff had become aware of Erso's treason before Krennic had was unforgivable. Krennic had already determined how his people inside Tarkin's organization had been kept in the dark. Leaks and obfuscation were the nature of the game. But how had he not personally seen the betrayal in Galen? For all Galen's faults, he had never been an equivocator. Nor had he ever failed to take pride in his own genius. For him to disrupt the work, to disrupt their work, all they had built these past decades?
to have somehow hidden his motives from Krennic, who knew him so well. How was it possible? Had he miscalculated? Could another scientist at the Edu laboratory been responsible instead? Have I become blind? But no. While Galen was a fluke, Krennic had not failed to spot Tarkin's greed, only failed to anticipate its precise manifestation, thanks to Galen's interference. Therefore, Galen was the priority and needed to be dealt with swiftly. Much as Krennic loathed to leave the Death Star now, he could not afford to let his problems accrue. He would eliminate them in sequence, leaving Tarkin for last. He had found weapons he might use against Tarkin already. He only needed an opportunity. He boarded his shuttle, accompanied by his death troopers, just after midnight station time. He'd settled himself in his seat with a glass of wine and a data pad by the time they'd left the docking bay.
"Course set for Edu, sir,"
his pilot announced. Krennic barely heard. Galen Erso. Galen Erso, whom he'd given every chance. Galen Erso, whom he nearly died for once on that sad scrap of farmland. "I thought we were past this," Krennic murmured to himself with a bitter smile, and his thumb dug into the screen of his datapad until the surface cracked and he began to bleed.
Supplemental data. No confirmation. Document number RJ9002C. Jedha query. Forged timestamp unreadable. Actual timestamp presumed concurrent with the Jedha crisis. Sent from Mon Mothma to General Draven and six other recipients. Operation Fracture Oversight.
I just received a troubling message from a contact in the Senate. She claims that a total evacuation of Imperial forces has taken place on Jedha, and that there are rumors of a massive energy burst in orbit. Her source conducts illegal asteroid mining at the far edge of the Jedha heliosphere, and she stresses that instrument error is a possibility. Nonetheless, she's seeking additional information from me. Whether she knows more than she's sharing and what exactly she suspects, I'm not sure. Can we confirm this data? Do we have an update on Operation Fracture? Document number RJ9002D. Reply to Jedha query. Sent from General Rhea to Operation Fracture Oversight.
I don't have any new information, but can you clarify? Did you tell this contact about the rumors of a planet killer? If not, this could be a fishing expedition by the Empire. She may want to see how you react to a full story.
Document number RJ9002E. Reply to Jedha query. Sent from Mon Mothma to Operation Fracture Oversight.
Some brief background. My contact refuses to aid the Alliance directly, but she's kept in touch with me since my departure from the Senate. If she can be won over, she could be important to our political strategy. I don't think she's serving Imperial military interests. I have not shared anything about the planet killer with her. If we can't confirm her data, however, I'd like to judiciously broach the subject. It may serve us in both the short and long terms.
Document number RJ9002F. Reply to Jedha query. Sent from Admiral Raddus to Operation Fracture Oversight.
We have a cargo freighter outfitted for long-range scans, four stops down the nearest hyperlane from Jedha. She's tasked on another operation, but I can divert her if Captain Andor doesn't report in soon. I find the possibility that the planet killer is a Jedha extremely troubling.
Document number RJ9002G. Reply to Jedha query.
sent from General Draven to Operation Fracture Oversight. I'm working as we speak to obtain solid intel on Jeddah. For now, there is no confirmation of any unusual Imperial activity. Strongly recommend that we do not share our intelligence and do not initiate new investigations. I will update the group on Operation Fracture and Captain Andor's status when I have reliable information that can be securely shared. Until then, suggest we shut down this conversation as a precaution. Chapter 10. Cassian Andor had made an error. Like a hairline fracture in a blaster barrel, it was nearly invisible on cursory inspection. When its repercussions manifested, however, they would do so with devastating effect. Cassian would very likely die, though that wasn't what bothered him most. He knew now that he should have left Jyn Erso on Jeddah. Better yet, he should never have taken her off Yavin 4.
"You're showing indications of stress,"
K2 declared. He sat beside Cassian in the cockpit, monitoring the instruments.
"You should be careful. You're a much worse pilot when you're stressed."
Cassian offered a wan smile. "How can you tell?"
"You overcorrect with the throttle control."
Not what I meant, he thought, but he didn't clarify his question. For all K2's social dysfunction, or perhaps his disinterest in organic socialization, who could fathom the mind of a droid? He knew Cassian better than anyone. He'd seen Cassian commit acts even Draven wasn't aware of. On Genoport, he'd found Cassian staring at his blaster with tears on his face. K2 had volunteered for a memory wipe in case Cassian's continued dignity and service demanded it. K2, Cassian knew, would gladly subdue Jyn Erso and lock her somewhere safe. If the Guardians of the Wills hadn't been aboard, Cassian might have been tempted to try.
"We're approaching Edu. Exiting hyperspace in 4 minutes.
Set our approach vector and get Bodhi in here. I want his eyes on the landing zone."
As K2 obeyed, Cassian returned to his thoughts. Jin's fervor in the cabin had been almost inspiring. Maybe it had inspired Chirrut and Baze and Bodhi, none of whom he really knew, none of whom he could trust. Just as her fire had spread to him, made him view her with a sort of awe in the Jedi Holy Quarter. But the stakes were different now. The planet killer, the Death Star, was real. General Draven had determined that eliminating its creator was the best way of ensuring the survival of the Rebel Alliance. If Cassian could stop one more incident like Jeddah City, his duty was obvious. Jyn would have argued that her father had already provided another way, that his sabotage gave the rebellion a chance to stop the Death Star now, albeit at a terrible risk. Jyn's judgment, however, was compromised. Her fire would burn them all. When Cassian had found her and saw Guerrera's chambers, she'd been lost in oblivion, awaiting her own death. He couldn't imagine the forces that had shaped her in life. He didn't doubt she was a woman of extraordinary strength, yet whatever message Saw had shown her had broken her completely. She was feigning strength now. She clung to her father's instructions for reasons entirely unrelated to the galaxy or the Alliance. If those instructions led her and everyone around her to their doom, would she even notice? Would she care? Her terrible need had returned. It couldn't end in anything but disaster, no matter how prettily she dressed it in the clothes of the rebellion. And if Cassian denied her what she wanted, if he assassinated Galen Erso, she would surely be twice as dangerous. Edu was a night world, even during the day, shrouded in storm clouds so thick that Cassian was forced to rely on scanners as they descended through the troposphere. From above, there was nothing to see but slate-gray thunderheads and flashes of light. The panorama was nearly peaceful. But the moment the U-Wing broke through the cloud cover, gales battered the ship as water drummed on the hull and streamed down the viewport.
Low!
Bodhi hissed, gripping the back of Cassian's seat. He was freshly scrubbed and bandaged, and smelled distractingly of cheap cleaning products and disinfectant. His formerly distant, terrified voice sounded almost human again.
Lower!
Cassian angled downward as much as he dared. He imagined the rainwater wriggling into 100 metal seams wedged open during the Jedha sandstorm, droplets creeping among exposed electronics and shorting critical systems.
This ship was not meant to be flown this way,
K2 observed. The U-Wing emerged from a fog bank to reveal the landscape below. 100 jagged rock formations, broad mesas, and narrow spires, rising from an uneven ground. A narrow canyon wove between the deadly ridges, its boundaries barely discernible in the storm.
They have landing trackers, Bodhi said. They have patrol squadrons. You've got to stay in the canyon. Keep it low.
Cassian nodded, adjusted his altitude, and checked his scanners for TIE fighters. He found nothing, though he wondered whether ships so small would even show up in the maelstrom. K2 increased thrust as the wind momentarily dropped off. The U-Wing lurched and Cassian's teeth smacked together.
If we proceed, there's a 26% chance of failure.
How much farther?
Cassian shot at Bodhi.
I don't know,
Bodhi said.
I'm not sure. I've never really come this way.
I figured that, Cassian thought. They were skimming over a spire, no more than 10 meters above the summit.
But we're close. I know that. Now there's a 35% chance of failure.
Cassian toggled the landing lights. They'd be easily spotted by any patrol squadron overhead, but his visibility was nil.
I don't want to know,
he said, not glancing at the droid.
Thank you. I understand. I'd prefer ignorance myself.
The spire fell away beneath them, and Cassian descended farther into the canyon. The broken walls curved one way and then another, following the course of a dozen writhing streambeds. The rocks were too close, came up too fast, but if Cassian reduced speed any more, they'd be at the total mercy of the storm.
Now!
Bodhi shouted and slammed a hand on Cassian's seat back.
Put it down now!
The wind,
K2 started. But Bodhi was squeezing between the seats, gesturing at something through the rain.
If you keep going, you'll be right over the shuttle depot. Put it down now!
Cassian swore. Bodhi was right. What he'd mistaken for refracting raindrops on the viewport was a series of distant floodlights. A landing pad for Imperial spacecraft. He cut the ship's speed. Almost immediately, the wind caught beneath the starboard wing, sent the U-Wing veering toward the side of the canyon. K2 tried to bank, but a ridge of black stone came up too fast for even a machine's reflexes. A ledge clipped the U-Wing, and Cassian slammed forward in his restraints, crying out as the ship trailed sparks and went into a steep decline. The dashboard was red with warning lights.
Hold on tight!
Cassian shouted.
We're coming in hard!
Whether anyone in the cabin heard him in the tumult, he couldn't guess. K2 extended the landing gear and activated the retro rockets in a futile attempt to break their speed. When they struck the planet's surface, the U-Wing's underbelly screamed violently against mud and stone, while momentum carried them forward. For almost half a minute, they plowed on as the ship's hull threatened to shred. When the U-Wing finally stopped, cockpit cracked and half buried in gravel and mire, Cassian was certain the ship wouldn't fly again. The rain had tapered to a cold, cruel drizzle by the time Cassian finished a cursory inspection of the damage. His initial assessment had been correct. The U-Wing was largely intact, but the port engine had been dashed into the rocks and was beyond repair. Most of the other components, long- and short-range comms included, were salvageable but non-functional.
he could still complete his mission. He could still kill Galen Erso. But he hadn't planned to end the day stranded on Edu. He pictured himself picking his way through the canyons, hunted by both stormtroopers and Jin. He was in a sour mood when he marched back into the cabin. He looked at the faces before him, the zealots, the defector, the madwoman, and K2, and felt a new rush of ire. They'd had opinions on the mission until it had gone south. Now they expected a solution from him. The only one he even trusted was the Imperial droid. "Bodhi," he snapped. Rainwater streamed down his forehead onto the cabin floor. "Where's the lab?" Bodhi straightened and took an awkward step forward, like a soldier being called to attention. "The research facility? The place you made deliveries and met Galen Erso. Where is it?" Bodhi trembled for a moment. Cassian debated whether to push harder or coddle the man, but then the pilot stilled and said crisply, "It's just over the ridge. And that's a shuttle depot straight ahead of us? You are sure of that?" "Yes," Bodhi said.
A satellite image would have been preferable, but Cassian had worked with worse than the word of a scared traitor.
"We'll have to hope there's still an Imperial ship left to steal. The U-Wing is scrap."
No one looked surprised. Bayes smiled sardonically.
"Grab anything that might be useful," he went on. "K2 will burn anything sensitive."
Alliance ships were programmed not to keep Navi records, and all identification had been scrubbed long ago. Cleanup wouldn't be hard.
"After that, here's what we're doing."
He waited for an argument that didn't come. Bodhi still stood at attention. Bayes regarded Cassian like he was judging him at trial. Chirrut looked distracted, cocking his head as if listening to the rain. And Jin? Jin seemed pale and gaunt compared to the woman he'd met on Yavin. Even her momentary zeal after leaving Jedha was gone, revealed as a pretense to drag them into her madness. She watched him somberly, sadly, like she was sure he would disappoint her. She was probably right about that.
"Hopefully," he said, "the storm keeps up and keeps us hidden down here. Bodhi, you're coming with me. We'll go up the ridge and check out the research facility."
"I'm coming with you,"
Jin said. That didn't take long, but he'd planned for it.
"No," he said. "Your father's message. We can't risk it. You're the messenger."
Jin scowled.
"That's ridiculous. We all got the message. Everyone here knows it."
K2 spoke for the first time.
"One blast to the reactor module and the whole system goes down. That's how you said it. The whole system goes down."
"You!" Cassian shot toward K2. "Get to work fixing our comms."
He forced himself to moderate his voice, to sound reasonable, before returning to Jin.
"All I want to do right now is get a handle on what we're up against. And even if I were ready to extract your father, I wouldn't be stupid enough to try on my own. I need you for firepower. And at this moment, I need you protecting the ship."
She returned to that intense, somber stare.
"Good enough."
"So,"
he said, and nodded at Bodhi.
"We're going to go very small and very carefully up the rise and see what's what. Let's get out of here."
There were no questions, and Cassian kept his eyes on his gear as he checked his equipment and reconfigured his blaster, slapping scope and extended barrel into place with rapid, familiar motions. At least, he thought, the weaponry survived the crash. He heard Bodhi's footsteps behind him as he trudged back out into the rain and the mud, his soul sucking noisily at the drenched soil.
"Do I need one too?"
Bodhi called. Cassian cast a look backward at the man as he crept down the slick boarding ramp.
"A weapon?"
"You sound like my droid,"
Cassian said. Then he grunted and shook his head.
"We won't be long. You'll be fine."
It was probably true. And there was a fringe benefit. If Bodhi sided with Jin over Cassian, it meant one fewer person who might shoot him in the back.
Chin hadn't spoken to the others during the journey from Jeddah. When Bodhi had approached her, tried to ask about Galen, she'd managed a gentle smile before waving him off. Chirrut and Baze had known better than to try talking, or perhaps they, like Jin, wrestled with truths too difficult to express in words. So she had listened to the hologram of her father in her mind and watched the dark of the cave become the darkness of Edu. The fact that she had no way to leave the planet lay discarded in her consciousness, untouched and irrelevant. "Does he look like a killer?" She was watching Cassian and Bodhi descend into the mud when she heard Chirrut's voice. She turned to look and saw he was speaking to Baze.
"No," Baze said after a moment of thought. "He has the face of a friend."
"Who are you talking about?" she asked.
Baze eyed her appraisingly.
"Captain Andor,"
he said, flat. She should have been irritated by the curt explanation. Instead, she could muster only vague confusion.
"Why do you ask that?"
she said, looking to Chirrut now.
"What do you mean, does he look like a killer?"
"The Force moves darkly near a creature that's about to kill,"
Chirrut answered. He might have added,
"As simple as that."
"Fascinating,"
K2SO called, heading for the cockpit.
"His weapon was in the sniper configuration."
Jin pictured Cassian assembling his weapon and exiting the ship. She remembered the first time she'd held a sniper rifle, staring down the scope under Saw Gerrera's direction, measuring her breath so she could confidently, quietly, kill a man from a kilometer away. It might have meant nothing. Her heartbeat quickened. She spun toward the boarding ramp and started down into the mud. The chill crept through her boots, up her legs and her spine. She couldn't see the path Cassian and Bodhi had taken, couldn't hear them over the steady rain, but she could see the dim, distant light of the Imperial compound. There, she would find her father. Baze Malbus watched a gust of wind spatter raindrops across the cabin floor, discoloring the metal in 1,000 pinpoints like bleak stars in a gray sky. The rain smelt like fecund soil with an undertone of acrid stink. Baze was not a young man. He had seen rain before, but Jeddah's rains, rare, powerful torrents that were cause for celebration, that he had taken such joy in as a child, had never smelt like this. Soon, Baze thought, he would forget the smell of Jeddah's rain altogether. Chirrut rose abruptly, swept his staff before him, and marched toward the boarding ramp.
"Where are you going?"
Baze growled. Chirrut paused but kept his back to Baze.
"I'm going to follow Jin. Her path is clear."
"Alone?"
Baze asked.
The word was volatile with meaning.
"Good luck."
He was certain Chirrut understood his warning. But the blind man, once brother to Baze among the Guardians of the Wills, and now the fool Baze was cursed to entertain, started forward again.
"I don't need luck," Chirrut said. "I have you."
Baze watched Chirrut descend the ramp. He listened to the foot of the staff rap on metal. When the rapping ended and Chirrut stepped onto soft ground, Baze heaved himself to his feet. Without a glance at the cabin, he followed his brother into the storm of an alien world. The tragedy of K2SO's existence was this. The skills he most cherished were skills his rebel masters disdained, and the skills he considered crude and trivial were skills his masters were helpless to learn. Thus his present circumstances. Instead of traveling to the research lab to manhandle, capture, restrain, and extract the scientist Galen Erso, a mission virtually requiring the talents of an Imperial security droid, and which might, if handled delicately, permit the exercise of multiple underutilized procedures hard-coded into K2SO, He was rewiring a communications array and locating faults in each of 84 connectors by touch. Such a task required a bare minimum of computational power. K2SO had more than enough to spare to listen to the goings-on in the cabin and observe the landscape from the half-buried cockpit viewport. He watched Jin depart with disinterest. The woman had always verged on disrespectful toward him. He watched Baze and Chirrut depart with more robust disapproval. He posited an array of scenarios involving their separation from the U-Wing, few of which ended in their continued well-being.
"What are they doing?"
he asked sharply. K2SO was not a protocol droid, but he was designed for biological interaction. He found that verbal discussion, even with himself, spurred his creativity. He soon came to a solution he was satisfied with.
"If Cassian comes back, we're leaving without them."
Chapter 11. Captain Cassian Andor had failed. That was the assumption Draven had to make. He had activated the homing beacon aboard Andor's U-Wing immediately after receiving his agent's supposed confirmation of the planet killer. The beacon was a risk, but a minor one. Its signal was disguised as pulsar radiation and relayed through a dozen unstaffed rebel outposts before reaching Base One. And under the circumstances, Draven thought it wise to keep tabs on Andor. He had the utmost respect for his agent, for Cassian, but only a fool would stake the fate of the Alliance on a single man. Much as Draven detested the fact, this mission had taken on such unlikely proportions. "Try them again," he said. He stood behind Private Weems in the communications room, looking over the man's shoulder as he tapped at his console. Two of Draven's captains stood with him, officers he trusted as well as Andor, albeit for different reasons.
"I am trying, sir," Weems said. "The signal's gone dead."
"Guess wildly for me. Why?" He turned toward his captains. Better to get the speculation over with.
"We know Andor made it to the Edu star system." It was Captain Nyoma who spoke first, analyst and technical advisor for Alliance Intelligence, a mumbling genius who hadn't slept since she'd first heard rumors about the planet killer. Could have been shot down, could have been shot at, though the beacon's rugged enough to survive a lot of damage. "We don't have much intel on Edu, though, so for all we know, the signal's blocked by a high-energy thermosphere."
"How likely is that?" Draven asked.
"Not likely."
He grunted, leaned his weight against the back of Weems' chair.
"Say we wanted to send in Blue Squadron. How long to Edu?"
Captain Vinaris had been, of all things, a spaceport control officer before joining the Rebellion. He had the numbers for half a dozen hyperspace routes at hand. He factored in variable atmospheric conditions and rapidly ran through the lot with Draven. "Short version, we're in striking range. But if the Empire's begun to evacuate, we won't catch them. Best case, Blue Squadron arrives just in time to see the Imperials jump out." "But would the Empire bother to evacuate at all?" Draven tried to put himself in the mind of the commander in charge of Edu's garrison. "I just caught a transport. A Rebel Alliance Intelligence U-Wing making a recon run over my base. I shot the ship down and even took prisoners. It was only one ship. It was a threat to operational security, but it wasn't cause for panic. If the Alliance knew for certain what was on Edu, they'd come en masse, and the work being done on Edu was vital. If the decision was made to uproot, the base's chief scientist would need to be the last to go to ensure everything was safely relocated. You couldn't trust stormtroopers with the delicate equipment. So Galen Erso was still on site. The planet killer might not die with him, but if Erso really was responsible for its main weapon, It would be a hell of a lot harder to keep operational after he was gone.
Squadron up, Draven said.
Target Edu. We must take out Galen Erso if we have the chance.
Captain Vynaris was running from the room, speaking into his comlink almost before Draven had finished. Nyoma was looking at him with bloodshot eyes.
Do you have authorization? She asked.
A full-scale attack on a major Imperial installation.
Anyone else, Draven would have taken aside and rebuked for questioning him in public.
But Nyoma had never possessed a military mindset, and she looked like she'd turned to dust at a stern word.
The mission's under my department, he said. I don't need the council sign-off. That was true. What he didn't tell Nyoma was that, authorized or not, the mission had crept well outside the council's intended parameters.
He'd been hoping to withhold Andor's report of the planet killer over Jedha until after debriefing the captain himself, revealing the truth, if it was true to the council members, without context, would only encourage them to pursue their own leads, activate their own contingencies, all without coordination or strategy. Half the Alliance would run and hide, while the other half would take the offensive. Word would spread outside the Council in a matter of hours, inciting panic.
Any hope of using knowledge of the Planet Killer as a form of leverage, to manipulate a vote in the Senate, to bring Saw Gerrera zealots back on side, would be lost. Draven worked for Alliance Intelligence. His job wasn't to share every secret he came across. It was to explain what secrets meant, if and when they were safe to share. He couldn't do that yet. But the Council was going to hear about his activation of Blue Squadron. Mon Mothma was going to want to know when the mission had become about assassination, rather than extraction. Blue Squadron would be en route to Edu in a matter of minutes. Draven had until it arrived to prepare for the conversation.
No, no! Bodhi called, rivers of rainwater dribbling off his hair and beard. We've got to go up!
Cassian frowned at Bodhi, then glanced down the slope of the muddy canyon at the distant shine of the laboratory lights. He could have questioned the pilot, but his mood was still sour, and he didn't see the use. Either Bodhi knew the topography or he didn't. Either he was lying or he wasn't. He shrugged and followed Bodhi up the rocky, rain-slick slope. At least it took them out of the worst of the mud. As they trudged up the ridge, Bodhi nattered on about his time on Edu. Cassian half listened to the pilot's stories of running cargo flights, delivering kyber crystal from Jedha to the local scientists. Bodhi had barely been authorized, he claimed, to access the mess hall while on site, to refresh himself and refuel before heading back to Jedha.
If I hadn't started a conversation with Galen in the meal line, asked him which droid to grab a bite from, maybe I never would have wondered what was going on here, what they were working on.
It sounded too much like a lie for Cassian to really believe it. But it also sounded like a lie for Bodhi's benefit, not Cassian's. If that was the story he wanted to tell about meeting Galen, so be it. If Bodhi was scared of Cassian, desperate to convince him his defection was genuine, that was fine with Cassian, too.
Eventually, Bodhi stopped talking as the path grew narrower. Cassian saw the pilot stumble and noticed the stiffness in the man's legs, the way he bent his knees as little as possible, more so the longer the hike went on. He noticed, too, the dark bruises and the raw, scraped flesh at the back of Bodhi's neck.
These were largely concealed by the collar of his flight suit, but the rain had tamped the suit down and left them more evident than before. "How long did Saw Gerrera's people hold you?" Cassian called.
Bodhi flinched but kept walking.
"What?"
Cassian repeated his question.
"A few days, maybe,"
Bodhi said, not looking back.
Cassian thought back to the rumpled pile of a man he had found in the catacombs, malnourished and battered and deranged with trauma.
Less than a day later, the man leading him through the canyons of Edu was transparently terrified and far too eager to chat. But he was also doing his damnedest to feign normalcy on what looked likely to be a suicide mission. He was even doing a decent job of it. Cassian laughed. It was a brief guttural sound that seemed drowned in the rain. Bodhi did look back now, surprised and a touch alarmed.
What?
He asked.
Nothing,
Cassian said. Then he added, blunt and almost humbled,
must have been a hell of a few days.
Bodhi smiled, just a twitch of his lips, for the first time since Cassian had known him. They climbed higher. Cassian could make out a platform across a narrow valley now, a raised landing pad separate from the shuttle depot. But the path up the ridge was turning increasingly treacherous. Soon it almost disappeared altogether, and Bodhi drew up against the rock face as scree poured from beneath his feet.
"I'll be right behind you,"
Cassian said, with as much reassurance as he could muster. Bodhi looked sickly, but he nodded.
"Come on!"
They crossed the next switchback with agonizing care. Beyond, the path widened again, and after a final ascent they crested the ridge and looked down onto the Imperial installation from above. The flat metal sweep of the landing pad abutted a series of military-spec housing and laboratory stations. Cassian recognized the prefab designs, but the labs at least looked heavily customized. He spotted whole swaths of unfamiliar antenna equipment and generators. He shuffled forward and knelt behind a boulder, felt the cool jab of damp pebbles against his knees. Next, he pulled Bodhi down beside him and fished out his quadnox, magnifying and surveying the installation. There was activity on the landing pad. Stormtroopers emerging in formation from one of the buildings, followed by figures in blue and white engineering jumpsuits. Cassian held the quadnox out to Bodhi without taking his own eyes off the platform.
"Take a look," he said. "You see Urso out there?"
Bodhi raised the quadnox, shook his head incrementally, and then stilled.
"That's him,"
he said after a moment.
"That's him, Galen, in the dark suit."
His voice hitched in excitement.
Cassian snatched the quadnox and scanned the platform again.
Among the engineers was a man in gray and blue, with a sharp, angular face and a scalp covered in wisps of frosted hair. Cassian sought a resemblance to Jin and found it in the man's eyes, deep-set and staring. Galen was speaking to the other engineers. The rain made them all look sodden and haggard, displeased at being brought outside so late. Cassian frowned. Why were they there? Had he and Bodhi tripped some alarm? Were they waiting for evacuation? He almost didn't notice the rumbling in the distance, wrote it off as part of the storm. But the sound was too even in pitch and grew louder too fast. He wrapped an arm around Bodhi and pulled the pilot flat onto the ground as a broad-winged Imperial shuttle swooped overhead and made for the platform.
"Do they ever bring the engineers out for deliveries?"
Cassian hissed. Bodhi coughed as rainwater caught in his nostrils, then shook his head vigorously.
"Not like this! Not this time of night!"
"Then something's off. Maybe it wasn't related to the arrival of the U-Wing. Maybe it was connected to Jeddah. The Empire cleaning up its production facilities now that the Death Star was operational. The shuttle was a Delta-class long-range model, used for passengers more than cargo. Whatever was happening, now might be the only opportunity to act. Cassian put the quadnox to one side and unslung his rifle. He checked its settings, balanced it on the rocks, and shifted his position as he spoke to Bodhi.
"You need to get back down there," he said, "and find us a ride out of here. You understand?"
"What are you doing?"
Cassian put an eye to the rifle scope, saw nothing but a blur atop the platform. He adjusted his magnification and filters, let the internal computer compensate for the sheets of rain.
"You heard me.
he said.
He made his voice hard, tried to erase any warmth that had sparked between him and the pilot. He couldn't afford an argument now.
You said we came up here just to have a look.
Bodhi snapped back.
Lie to him. Tell him you need to keep Galen alive and on Edu. And you don't know what that shuttle could mean.
I'm here, Cassian said. I'm looking. Go.
The platform crystallized. More Imperials were emerging from the buildings. He adjusted his aim and began seeking the face of Galen Erso. He heard Bodhi's soft, rapid breathing at his side.
Hurry!
Cassian snarled. Bodhi's boots tossed flecks of stone onto Cassian's jacket as he ran. During the flight to Edu, Krennic had stoked the fury in his heart. Fueled by outrage and humiliation, its fire burned bright enough to warm him in the chill that swept through the shuttle, to ward off the ice of the raindrops that assailed him as he descended the boarding ramp onto the landing platform. The boots of his death squad squealed against wet metal as he drew to a stop and surveyed the assortment of stormtroopers, officers, and engineers before him. The troopers had corralled the engineers, miserable as wet hounds, standing in a loose, indecorous cluster at one end, while the facility's senior officers were aligned about the shuttle, doing their best to ignore their indignity in the presence of the director. The garrison commander stepped forward to offer a welcome, but Krennic waved her off. He had no interest in delaying what he had come to do. The engineers looked nervously at one another. Krennic noted each in turn, recalled his name, studied his posture. Most he did not know overly well. He had hand-selected Uyon out of the Brentau Futures program, the same program Krennic and Galen had completed together, and been mildly disappointed in the results ever since. Uyon stood straight-backed, expression vacillating between fear and deluded, desperate hope. Onopen, conversely, looked ready to curse loudly about bureaucratic interference and bury his obvious worry beneath a thin layer of professional pride. Krennic liked Onopen, but he hoped he would remain silent this once. None of them showed any hint of defiance. Krennic looked to Galen Erso. The man stepped forward, blinking the raindrops out of his eyes. He held himself as if Krennic's presence neither surprised nor concerned him.
"Well, Galen," Krennic said, "at last it's complete. You must be very proud."
"Proud as I can be, Krennic."
It was false humility, of course. Krennic was certain of that.
"Gather your engineers," he said. "I have an announcement to make."
Galen barely gestured. The engineers drifted, herd-like, from one side of the platform to the other, until they stood before Krennic and Galen together. They huddled as if to share heat in the spitting storm and ward off their collective dread.
"Is that all of them?"
Krennic asked, though he already knew the answer.
"Yes,"
Galen said. Krennic smiled acidly and said the words he had selected with care aboard the shuttle.
"Gentlemen, one of you has betrayed the Empire. One of you conspired with a pilot to send messages to the rebellion. I urge that traitor to step forward."
On cue, Krennic's death squad took position and leveled its weapons at the engineers. There were too many people on the landing pad. Cassian kept his rifle propped against the stone, ignored the trickle of rain like sweat down his spine, and tried to draw a bead on Galen. But there were stormtroopers in the way now, and his shot became no clearer once the shuttle landed and the crowd reconfigured itself. He swore to himself and waited. He dredged his memory to try and identify the officer in the white cape and found the name Orson Krennic, some sort of project director apparently attached to the Planet Killer.
If by some miracle Cassian got off a second shot, he decided Krennic would make an excellent target. The Empire could only be improved by the loss of another high-ranking blowhard, but that would be a bonus.